This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 78. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com and enter offer code IMPROVE at checkout. A better web starts with your website. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I am joined by Darren Meller. Darren is going to be joining me on a regular basis on the podcast, so get used to his voice. I'm really glad to have you on the show, Darren.
Thanks so much, Jim. It's been an honor to be on the first show, and I can't wait to work alongside you moving forward.
Well, we have a ton to talk about today. There's just a lot going on in the photo world. And our goal today is, you know, talk about some of the fun stuff going on to let you know what's out there, but also a few products that we think you shouldn't spend your money on, and a couple also that we hope you will be able to spend your money on, because they're products that have been teased that we think are coming out, but have not been officially announced yet. So Darren, you were telling me about the first one, is this Flashlight Fusion. Tell me a little bit about it. What does it do?
Well, actually, I stumbled across this on my Facebook newsfeed, and it's pretty much a combination of a flashlight diffuser with an LED backing. And it has some advantages here and there to where you can not have to back up if you're shooting in a chapel or something like that.
Wait, sorry. So it's LED mm-hmm. on the outside. So you're getting a constant LED light that's always on. It's not like a flash. And then on the inside, you hook it up to your normal speed light flash, and it has like this ball that you can rotate around and point where the main speed light flash is going. Is that right?
That's perfectly correct. And as before I went off on a tangent there, yes, you would, in one situation, you would point it up at the ceiling if you wanted to use it as a bounce flash, and then also incorporate using the LED panel at the same time, so you didn't have to back up as a photographer to, you know, not illuminate the background versus the subject of what you're photographing.
Right, because this is something we do all the time. You know, if you're shooting a wedding reception, any kind of event, family, even, you know, your kids running around the living room, usually the way that you're going to use a speed light is you'll put the flash on your camera, you'll point it up at the ceiling, and then you pull up the little bounce card. You may not have, I bet a lot of people own speed lights and don't even know it has a bounce card. It's just above the flash head. There's this little thing, and you grab it out and pull it out. And it just bounces a little bit of the light from the flash to shoot forward to like fill up the eyes and give you a catch light. And then most of the light is bouncing off the ceiling and back down. And by bouncing it off the ceiling, it's a lot softer. So that's the idea with this, and that's what we do with speed lights all the time. The difference is that this isn't just bouncing a little light off the bounce card. It's using the LED to light in front of you, the person straight in front of you, and this flash to do the bounce light.
Correct. And then also it's you can use the LED by itself as well too, but looking at some of the shots here that I've seen, it actually almost blows the photo out, and it looks like it makes it look like the white balance is very, very cool.
Yeah, so this is a project on Indiegogo, which is just like Kickstarter basically. And so it's something, it's, you know, one of those deals where you come back and then, you know, they'll eventually make the product and send it to you. The price is expensive, though. This is not a cheap thing. Is it like a $200 now?
Yeah, right now, if you get in on the early bird special round two, they're selling it for $215. And then if you scroll down, they're actually showing it for $280 on their round three. For that. So it seems like the price might be over $300 as the final price point for this. And I'm not sure if it's really going to add $300 worth of value to your photography.
Well, especially when you consider that a YN560 is, you know, $65-$7 and you could buy what, four of those for this price. That's pretty extreme for just the diffuser.
Exactly. I think it's over the top. I like where they're going with the idea, but it's just filling a small niche. And if you can just step forward or step back in your shot to get the right shot with using bounce flash, I think that would solve your problem and save you almost $300.
Yeah, if this were a device that allowed me better control over the light from the bounce card, now we're talking. That's something that I could actually want, because sometimes the light from the flash that goes off the little bounce card, it looks like just a business card. The light from that can sometimes be a little bit too bright if you're close to the person. If you scoot a little bit back, it's not quite as bright. But there's no way to control that other than just scooting back. But so this would offer you control over that because you can control the brightness of the LEDs. But that's it. That seems like a very minor problem to fix with a $215, $280 product.
Yes, I would suggest putting the money elsewhere on that one.
Yeah, I don't know. I see these things coming up almost daily, certainly weekly. I'll get an email from a company that says, you know, they have schnazzy music behind their video and they say, "We're about to announce the best flash diffuser ever. It's never been done in the history of photography." And I always think, no, that's just a bounce card. Or, you know, that's just, you know, all these on-camera flash diffusers, you know, some of them do a little bit something different than another. But many of you will remember when we did a test of the Gary Fong light sphere versus just a piece of just chucking Tupperware on top of your flash, because a piece of Tupperware is going to bounce the light around too. And the difference was, well, I couldn't tell any difference. So I don't know. I guess when I see this and the many, many others that I get emailed to me all the time, I was just thinking, you know, it's kind of, I feel like it's preying on newer photographers that maybe don't quite understand that this really is not a problem. There's already a solution to this that we've been using for 50 years. It's called the bounce card. And I don't see how this is a more complicated solution, certainly a more expensive solution, but I just don't see what it does better. And I see these kind of devices all the time on Kickstarter and Indiegogo. Some are cool, but many of them are just useless. It just doesn't solve a real problem. It's fancy, but it doesn't solve a problem.
It doesn't. And honestly, if you want to pull your hair out and empty your pocketbook a little bit, then you could probably go for the product. But if you want to stay easy, just learn flash the correct way.
Yeah, and I feel like that's it. I feel like if you really know flash photography, I don't see how you'd be real excited for this unless you shoot like a wedding reception daily. And you always have the problem that your bounce card flash just is too much and you want to be able to control it, or some very small niche case. I just don't see this being a good idea for most photographers.
Exactly. I'm not really in line to buy it at the moment either, Jim.
And I feel bad because sometimes it's friends in the industry that send me stuff and say, "Hey, Jim, you know, I'd like your endorsement on this or that product." And a lot of times I just have to say, "I'm sorry, but this just isn't useful. It's not. It's cool, but it's not useful." And so I have to be tough. All right. Our next product that we don't quite see the use for, the Spider Cube, and to some extent the Spider Checker, but I do think the Spider Checker has utility. But this Spider Cube is basically, well, not basically, it is a gray card that's wrapped on a cube. So you know, it has white on one side, gray on one side, another gray on one side, black on one side, so that you can white balance to different shades. So it, you know, it looks like it's fine as a gray card, and it's there, but it's more expensive, a lot more expensive than a gray card, and there's kind of limited utility for this as well. What do you think of the Spider Cube, Darren?
I think it kind of looks like a square disco ball at first. I mean, if you don't find it useful as a gray card, then you can definitely hang it from your ceiling, point a constant light at it, and have a little bit of fun. But
yeah, disco ball. I was also thinking a substitute for fuzzy dice could be kind of cool.
Perfect, yeah. Maybe a substitute for fuzzy dice, yeah. But otherwise, with the cube, I don't see it as being is helpful. I mean, the spider checker that it's using inside that, because I'm looking on the website and there's a pro package on datacolor.com if you want to check it out, that has both the cube if you want your disco ball cube and the spider checker. And that's what they're saying, is that it's helping you calibrate your raw calibration in your camera in order to make sure that your colors are more true and you're spending less time in Lightroom and Photoshop adjusting white balance, contrast, and stuff like that. But if I actually take the amount of time I look at each photo in Lightroom and Photoshop and make those adjustments in Camera Raw and in Lightroom respectively, it's such a small amount of time. I don't really see a use for this. And we're looking at a decently high ticket item here at $179 for this kit.
Yeah, so the spider checker is giving you a palette of colors that you take a picture off, and then you white balance and color balance off of it. Is that right?
Yes. There's actually a little video in here that shows how to use it, and they have a real cheesy drawing of a couple holding it up in front of them. Like, I really couldn't imagine Yay! You or me saying, hey, hold up this color thing right in front of you while I'm taking your wedding pictures.
Yeah. And see, for some photographers, I get it. You know, if you're shooting product photography and you need, you know, to make sure the color is exactly how it was intended, I understand that. And that makes total sense. But for most photographers, and I see all the time, you know, newer photographers have only been shooting a year and they say, oh, yes, I got this thing and it's going to help me. And it ends up just slowing you down so much and complicating the process that eventually you just say, ah, this, you know, this photography stuff is just too complicated, because you're trying to use a product to solve something that's really just education. You really just need to learn how to manage your colors in Photoshop and Lightroom, and then this is kind of a non-issue. But there are some situations, again, where I have used something like the spider checker. I got an off-brand one that a company sent to me, and it worked well. I mean, it did exactly what it said it would do. I just don't know that I would use it often, and I don't. I don't use it very often. But the spider cube, I just don't get this thing at all. What is cumbersome about a gray card? Why can't you just get a $2 piece of paper that's gray, and it has to be the right shade of gray and everything, and shoot that? I don't understand why you need it in a cube shape, because then you've got to have like this little stand to make it stand because it's on a cube so you can see all the different angles. Like, this is just, it's adding complexity where there really is none. This is an easy problem to fix. Either just do this in Photoshop and eyeball your colors, which personally I find best most of the time. Or if you're shooting something where you really need precise color, then get a gray card. It costs $2. It's incredibly simple to use, and it's going to be just as accurate as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I agree. It'd be just as accurate, and who cares if the gray card gets lost or anything like that. It's a couple bucks to replace versus having to go out and buy a whole new cube and carry it around with you, because I would lose this thing in about a week.
Yeah, I wouldn't lose it because it would be on my rearview mirror. I'd want two, though.
There you go. Fuzzy
it's
dice.
It's perfect for a photography nerd. Just have your little spider cube on there. It's an interesting thing. Now, I was talking with one of the representatives from Nikon the other day, and he was preaching it in a workshop, just saying you've got to white balance every time in camera, and he, you know, gave some reasons for it, and one of his main reasons was that your white balance is going to change all the time as you point the camera in different areas of the room. And so, you know, you're going to have those fluctuating white balances. And his argument was that then when you put it into Lightroom, that you're going to have to white balance each one of those photos. And I don't think that's true at all. I would prefer to shoot in auto white balance if we have those fluctuations in color temperature around a room, because then I can bring it into Lightroom and I don't have to select everyone individually. I'll select the whole batch that was shot in that room and white balance one. And the advantage is if the, you know, let's say we're shooting in a part of the room that has kind of blended light, two different kinds. Well, the camera already auto white balance to that, that it's a little bit different in that part of the room. And then by auto white balancing or by white balancing all of them up to the correct level, then each one has the perfect variation of that part of the room. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, I think it makes complete sense. I constantly shoot on auto white balance as well. I was flying and I had someone tell me, you need to set your white balance all the time. But I did do that for a little bit, to be honest. And I went through a portrait shoot and I had to go through and adjust white balance a lot because I left it on, you know, I think it was daylight, and halfway through the shoot, it was cloudy, and we had the evenly diffused light, and it was more of a headache to have to consistently think that, oh gosh, I better change my white balance for this scene versus letting the camera do it. I know that we don't like to let our cameras do a lot of the thinking, but I think that it does a good job with white balance, especially when you're applying post-production to it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I find that it takes more time in post if you're setting the white balance in camera. Because of that, inevitably, you're not going to set it perfectly every time.
Yes, there's a huge margin of error. I wouldn't say huge, but there's a margin of error every time you set it. And it's just going to cause you more work in post-production. And I'm with you on post-production. I like to keep it as simple as possible so I can get my images out there.
Yeah, and the other thing is, it's just one more thing to worry about when you're shooting. Just, you know, it's one more thing to worry about when you should be focusing on the person you're shooting, the landscape, watching light, different things like that. So I just don't see this one at all. But the Nikon rep that I was talking to did have one really good point, and that is that the white balance on our cameras will not cover the entire range that the camera can white balance to. It won't go up to full, it won't go past daylight to a little bit bluer, and it won't go as warm as indoor photos are. So let's say, you know, you go into your living room and you take photos, and you know how they always have that yellow-orange cast to it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, the reason that the camera is not auto white balancing to that correctly is because the camera manufacturers intentionally set a range that the auto white balance won't go too blue or too yellow, just in case they're way wrong, and then your photo looks horrible. And so there's only a range of auto white balance works, which I think is a shame. I wish we could adjust that a little bit so that we could go further. But that was a good argument to set your white balance, especially where you're going to need a lot of blue or a lot of yellow to compensate for the light.
Exactly. And you can even apply it to gel shifting, as you've talked about in the past. So, I mean, there are applications to setting your white balance, but I leave mine on auto white balance probably 95% of the time.
Yeah, and that's a good point. When I am doing gel shifting, it just kind of makes sense to set it. It's too hard to visualize what the end photo is going to look like when you're not setting the white balance in camera if you're doing the gel shifting.
Exactly. And to your point, no matter what we do with our photos, if we're taking away from that ability to tell a story with each photo, and by doing something more complicated by using, you know, any of these systems we've mentioned so far, I think it's taking away from that story. I think your passion shines through when you set the settings to the best of your ability and just let your artistic passion drive the photo, not so much the critical thought behind it.
Yeah. And what I mean by when we both have been talking about gel shifting, just to be clear to those who don't understand, usually the way this works is you put a CTO gel, a color temperature orange gel, on your flash, and you point that at the person, and it makes the person turn really orange, but then you change the white balance so the person looks neutral, which then in turn makes the background look very, very blue. You could do it with any color, but usually that's the way you'll end up going.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that would be probably one of the best applications for it. Next on there, one product that I definitely wouldn't buy, if we can move on to that one, would be a newer camera that I saw come across the wire. It's called the Litro Allume. It's actually a different type of camera that you won't see out there, and it mainly focuses on light field photography. And a lot of the processing is done inside the camera, so it's a completely different type of camera. Have you heard of this one, Jim?
Yeah, so Litro came out with a little cube. Actually, that would be good fuzzy dice too.
There you go.
You could use a little Litro as fuzzy dice. But it's this little cube-shaped camera, you know, very small. And basically what it does is it allows you to control the depth of field after the fact. So it takes a picture, and then you can put it on the computer and change where your focus point is and give full depth of field, shallow depth of field. You can just control it. It's like you have raw capabilities over your aperture and focus point. So it's pretty cool, And then, but the problem is the camera was horrendous, the original Lytro. And it was cheap. It wasn't a whole lot of money. If I remember right, it was about $250. And it was a novelty. Nobody was using this for any kind of serious photography. It's a novelty. It was very low megapixels. I can't remember how many. It's like 2 megapixels or something. And now they've come out with this Lytro Illume that's basically a big boy camera that has this technology in it.
Yeah, and at first glance, I think it looks like a Nintendo DS with a fixed lens on it.
and it's kind of weird that it is a fixed camera, because if they're billing this as a serious camera, we don't do fixed lens. We just don't, because it's just so limiting to only have that.
Yeah, and if you're in the price point on this, they're wanting $1,500 for this or $1,499. So same thing, but To me, I wouldn't really say that anyone needs to go out and buy this camera. I mean, it goes from 30 to 250 millimeters on that fixed lens and shoots at f2. And as you were talking about earlier, you're able to go through the camera and also in post-processing and change that and go clear all the way to f16 to change what's in focus. But then it goes down another rat hole of a sort, because you're not able to really display or share these images that are coming out of the camera. Like Jim and I are taking a look at what this camera can do on the website, and we're trying to figure out how they're displaying it, because you can move in this website, there's water that is showing coming out of a jet, and you can move it around, zoom in on it, change the focal point. But how can you do that on Facebook, Instagram, you know, the Improved Photography website? You can't do that right now, I don't believe.
Right, it looks like they're using Silverlight to display it on the web, which is basically like Flash that you have on your browser, but it's Microsoft's technology. And so a lot of people don't even have the Silverlight plugin, even though Silverlight did get a boost when Netflix started using them. Now to watch Netflix, almost everybody's using the Silverlight plugin, so it definitely got a boost there. But a lot of people do not have the Silverlight plugin on their browser, and so they can't even see this, as far as I can tell, unless there's, you know, maybe a backup Flash if you don't have Silverlight installed. I'm not sure what they're doing there, but that would definitely be a concern. And even if they did, you're not seeing this on Facebook or Instagram, anything like that. This has got to be placed on a website to view it, or on your computer.
Yes, so if you're looking for a really expensive toy that you won't be able to share very many of your images with, then you might go down this path. But otherwise, this is one that I'd like to see the technology develop a lot more and maybe come to fruition on a more user-friendly camera that can share images.
Yeah, you know, I definitely believe that 10 years from now, we're going to have cameras that we can change the focus point after the fact. I don't even question that. I'm pretty confident that baby's coming. But I don't think it's going to happen like this. It could be in camera. It could be that, you know, once our ISOs get up high enough that we can shoot pretty much every photo at F22 and we get that full depth of field, or even F16, you know, once we're up there, then what we could do is do this with software. And the software could you know, tell how far things are away in the photo, and then once Photoshop knows how far each element in the photo is away from the camera, bang, this is simple. That can be done easy. The problem that Photoshop has now and other plugins that are doing with this with software that allow you to change the depth of field and where the focus point is one, you have to have full depth of field in your photo, which is sometimes tough to get. And then they don't know how far each element is, so it ends up looking wonky, and it just doesn't look as natural as if you'd shot this optically with a lens that focused on that spot.
Yes, yeah, I've seen a couple of photos that have been processed that way, and it just looks like an alternate reality in a lot of respects.
Yeah, I haven't seen a plugin yet that'll do this, you know, real slick. The results aren't that great, but I really think we're going to be able to do this. Whether it's going to happen in camera or in software, I don't know. I don't think Lytro is going anywhere. You know, maybe 5 years from now, somebody's going to play this clip on another podcast and say, "You idiot, you're wrong." Maybe I will be. But I very well could be. But I don't think Lytro is going anywhere. I think this sucker is going to die off, and die off quickly. I do think that software being able to do this after the fact, just with a regular camera, yes, I think that's coming.
Yeah, I think it's coming on the software side, but to buy a camera on this, it's so niche. It's almost like when I was in the market for, you know, a tilt shift lens, and everybody kept taking, you know, and saying, hey, that's really only going to be used for a couple applications. You need to think about what you can buy as far as photography gear that's going to take your photos to the next level and get you a shot that you're not currently able to get with what you have. And I don't foresee any uses with this piece of equipment to expand my photography or take it to any other level.
Yeah, I don't see this one going anywhere, especially at the $1,500 price point. If it's $1,500, I want to see a serious camera, and this isn't a serious camera yet.
No, it's a very expensive novelty.
But serious novelty. I mean, you're going to be cool at the photo walk. Everybody's going to want to be your buddy.
Oh, yeah. Everyone's going to be looking over your shoulder, and then when you tell them how much it costs, then they might get some different looks after that.
Yeah, that's right. I just bought a little fishing boat for $1,500.
See? That's a better purchase, in my opinion, already.
Yeah, that's right. How are you going to catch a fish with the Lytro?
Well, you'll see.
But before we go on, we want to take just a second and thank our sponsors. Fracture is a sponsor of the Improved Photography Podcast. I've told you about Fracture before. It's cool. It's just a totally different way to print. It's printing directly on glass, and it just gives great color. I have one on my shelf behind me, and if especially if you have a photo that has a lot of color in it, you know, printing on something that's laminated or has glass just makes a big difference on that. Have you tried, you know, these kind of different ways of printing than just the traditional paper, Darren?
Yeah, I've tried wood printing, canvas printing, all those, and I think printing on glass is a new medium, and I think it really would make those colors pop. I'm really excited about seeing how it would turn out using such an awesome medium.
Definitely something to try if you have a client. Especially if you're shooting for a client, they really like to feel like they get something real custom and unique with their photos. They don't want to feel like, you know, they got the same wallets that every other customer got. So, you know, if you have know these other mediums, and then when you have the shoot come where it's just, you know, somebody's wearing really vibrant colors and great flowers, something like that, then tell your clients about this, and they're very inexpensive, and the customer's going to expect it to cost a lot more. So it's something that you could get a good margin on too. Well, if you are like us and you want to print something on glass, then you can use coupon code PHOTOSONGLASS15 at FractureMe.com. That gives you 15% off. So but if you forget that, just go to ImproveFotography.com/78, and we'll have the link right there.
And we'd also like to thank Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy for you to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com and enter code IMPROVE at checkout. I love Squarespace, and I'm actually transitioning my website as we speak because I used a WordPress format and it didn't really have the images and the flow that I'd like. Have you had any experience with Squarespace, Jim?
Yeah, I have been checking it out. A lot of other photographers are using it. You know, Scott Kelby's using it, and lots of others, Tony Northrup. A lot of photographers are using it. And that's pretty cool that photographers are finding an easier way to do this. I really like WordPress. Improved Photography runs on WordPress. But also, if you're just looking for a portfolio and you want something up and you want it to look really good without all the work, and you don't want to be the guy that has to go and fix the code when the server breaks it, then Squarespace is a really cool alternative. All right, so we talked about three products that we just don't buy them. They're no buys as far as we're concerned. Each of them does have their own very niche use, but neither of us are really seeing promise here. But there are some products that we do want to talk about that we hope you will buy. Actually, we hope we will buy them. But there are things that are their cameras that have been leaked. There are definitely pretty strong rumors out at this point. but have not yet been announced. Now, nothing is going to be announced right now in the camera world. Not happening. Not till Photokina. So Photokina happens every other year. It's in Germany, and it's one of the biggest photography conferences in the world. I mean, this is, if you're going to make an announcement in the photo industry, Photokina, and that's the place to do it. So you'll see a lot of announcements happening toward the start of the year at CES time, and you know, that's what, February, and then you'll see in this October period every other year at Photokina, are a big time for announcements. And then you'll see a lot of lines, like the lower level cameras being announced, you know, in this October timeframe as well, because they want to be out there and have inventory before Christmas comes.
Exactly. And the first one that I've been hearing about for years, and I even had to laugh when I asked someone whether they were excited about it when I was photographing Sandhill Crane Migration in Kearney, Nebraska. I said, "Are you excited for the 7D Mark II?" And he said, "I've been excited for about 2 or 3 years since they announced it was going to come out. I'll be really excited when I actually see the thing."
Yeah, this is like the Nikon equivalent of the D3S. The D3S has been out for years, and every major conference, there's a rumor, finally, it's going to be updated. But no, the D300S is just gone. Now, the 7D, the original 7D, is old. O-L-D, old. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, this camera uses the same sensor as the Canon T2i, T3i, T4i, T5i, 60D, and the 7D. All of those use the same sensor. This is an old camera. It is definitely due for an update, but it's a great camera. I mean, I don't want to talk down on it. The 70 is an awesome camera. It's just old. It's definitely time for an update. So what kind of stuff do you think we'll see on the 70 Mark II?
The 70 Mark II, it looks like they're boasting 12 frames per second, which for a crop sensor camera, I think this is Canon's higher end crop sensor camera, it's going to beat out the 70D that I own as far as frames per second. It's going to be using a new CMOS sensor, dual pixel CMOS autofocus. There's so many really cool things about this, and Canon's finally deciding to put some autofocus points in there. It's supposedly going to boast 65 autofocus points, all cross type. So finally, we can have a Canon out there besides the 1DX and the 5D Mark III that can compete with a Nikon.
Yeah, it is time for that. Canon has been way too slow putting more focus points in the cameras, for sure. Especially on the less expensive camera. So I hope that comes to be. Now, GPS and Wi-Fi, I'm leaning towards yes. We saw it in the 6D, and so I'm thinking that we're gonna get the 7D Mark II. It seems that Canon is doing a better job with Wi-Fi in their cameras than Nikon is. Nikon seems to be just a little bit slower getting that into the line.
Very true. And with this one, like, and that was one thing that I had to think about when I bought the 70D, was it did not have built-in GPS. It has the built-in Wi-Fi, so you can shoot remote with an iPhone or an Android or Windows phone using the EOS app. However, this one I think is going to have both of them, and it's really going to make people question why the 70D, you know, is around anymore, because this one takes it to a whole new level. Like the 70D, my first impression was that it was pretty much a little bit better than the 6D minus the GPS, and almost as fast as the 5D Mark III, if not faster, with frames per second, depending on how you operate the camera. So this one here is really going to take it's going to dig into the market for the 70D and the 60D. I think that they're going to phase those out, and this is going to be their flagship crop sensor camera.
Yeah, I think it's time for that. I'm glad to see the high frame rate. The 7D, especially when it was announced, was very good on frame rate. It's been a great camera for that. Whether it's going to have GPS, it is a toss up to me. It seems like that's always the very last spec that nobody is ever sure on until the actual announcement. That seems to be one that I think camera manufacturers hold on to that one. Do we put this $5 thing into it or not? And GPS is very inexpensive to add to a product, but they've been pretty hesitant to do that.
Yes, it's taken them way too long to get them into all the cameras, but I think that moving forward, people really want that geotag. And if you're out hiking in the sticks and whatnot, you're going to want to know where you took that shot, because you're not going to remember some of the small names of the towns and villages you're going through.
Yeah, I definitely want it. I travel all the time doing photography, and you think you're going to remember that place until you look back in your Lightroom library from 4 years ago when you visited a city. And you're like, ah, shoot, I have no idea where that location is. Or, yeah, it happens all the time.
Oh, yeah. And there's plenty of times, even here in the small parts of Iowa, where there's a town that literally has a sign in a couple houses, and I get a really cool shot of a barn outside there, and I'll look at it and say, shoot, I didn't turn my GPS on. Which town is this? And I'll have to actually burn the fuel to go back out there and figure out where that barn was.
Right. Right. And it is helpful for that sometimes too, because sometimes I'll take a photo that I'm on private land and you just can't remember. I don't remember where I am. Am I going to have a property release problem with this? And I would love to be able to just grab the geotag and check on Google Earth and see exactly where I was. But you don't always know.
Yes, and I think that's going to come in to be very helpful. And last but not least, I did look over the 7D, and it is going to have the new video recording system that's being utilized on the 70D, because the 70D was actually hailed to be a really great video camera versus just being a good still life camera for still shots.
I think the camera manufacturers have been really, really pushing the video because it's opening up a new market for their products. What I'm seeing of most still photographers, the average still photographers, you know, there are a lot of people that are in the industry doing photography as a profession that they're really learning a lot of video. But most photographers that are in it as a hobby or a serious amateur or even professionally, most of them I'm not seeing adopting video and moving it toward it. So I think the reason camera manufacturers are excited is because they can give one camera that appeals to two different audiences. I just don't see as many photographers flocking to video like they were a few years ago when the early adopters started to really learn it.
Oh, yeah, and it's also a great way to cheat. My friend, he shoots a lot of video, and a lot of his great photos that I've commented on social media, I've said, where did you get that shot? Oh, it's a video, and I just pulled a still out of it. So it kind of gives them that route to go as well, too, and not really try to expand it when doing, you know, still shots versus doing video.
Yeah, which is a definite thing that we could be seeing in future years mostly as frame rates in video improve. Because the frame rate means, you know, let's say we're shooting 24p video. That's the video that you'll see on any movie you watch is 24. You watch something on TV, it's going to be 30 frames a second, but movies are usually 24. So if you watch a 24 frames, what that means is it's, you know, flipping 24 images from you in front of you every second. Now to get that, the photographer, the videographer is using a shutter speed of 1/50th of a second. Well, that's an obvious problem. If you're taking a photo at 50 frames a second, or you're taking a photo at 1/50th of a second, very often that's going to produce blur. It's not going to be a fast enough shutter speed. And so it's tough to take stills from video right now because frame rates are so slow that almost every frame has blur in it, just that you don't notice it because you're watching a fluid video happen. As frame rates get faster, and they're getting much faster, then we could see a huge difference here, because then the frame rates are fast enough. You know, when the shutter speed on a video is 1/250th, 1/500th of a second, and we're getting 4K stills, now that's a serious thing to pay attention to.
Very, very, very true. And I think that that's even better for when you're trying to get that really tough shot. Like, it takes a lot of patience to get certain shots. If you're out photographing lightning during the summer or any other time of the year where you're getting lightning, that takes a lot of patience to get that exact lightning bolt using a longer exposure. But if you're just shooting a video like on the 70D or 7D Mark II that they're saying is going to be 60 frames per second, there's probably going to be one frame in there with that lightning bolt that you're just going to love. So it's going to change things up a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know how many times I've sat out in the frozen cold with my finger ready on the shutter button, waiting for that eagle to take off the branch, you know, for it to finally take off. And it could sit there for 45 minutes. I've seen them sit there for 2 hours without moving. And I'm sitting there with my finger on the shutter button, ready to press it the instant that that eagle moves a muscle. Like, it would be so cool to just turn on video. And when the action happens, you go back to it. You're set. That'd be pretty sweet.
Yeah, that happened to me last winter. I actually went to, you know, blow into my hands to warm them up. And as soon as that happened, the eagle took right off the branch, went into the Mississippi River and grabbed a fish. And I was like, there's the shot.
Yeah. Might as well watch it because I didn't capture it.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, the 7D Mark II looks really cool. I think it's going to be a very popular camera if they can get the pricing right. I am a little bit concerned about what they're going to do with pricing here. Because the truth is, you can get a full-frame camera for not a whole lot of money these days. So do you think that we're going to see more people using the 7D Mark II? Or do you think it's going to be as popular of a camera now that there are very inexpensive full-frame options?
Well, when I was in the market and I was looking at both replacing a full-frame or having a backup camera with another full-frame, we did have a discussion between the two of us about how full frame and crop sensor have beneficial aspects to each of them. I think that marketing has made everybody kind of want to jump on the full frame bus, but there's so many advantages in my personal opinion to use a crop sensor, like the difference in depth of field, or for instance, another item I'm looking at of strapping a 400 millimeter lens on a crop sensor camera is going to give you inadvertently a 600 millimeter focal length. So I think there's advantages to both. I think that people are still going to dip their feet in the market as far as getting a crop sensor and moving up to a full frame. But everybody's mindset is, as soon as they buy that crop sensor, gosh, how soon can I get that full frame camera? So if they do the pricing incorrectly, I would definitely see someone jump towards a 6D. And if it's lower in price than the 7D Mark II, I think that that's very feasible.
Yeah, the Canon 6D right now is selling for $1,899 US dollars, and that's a full-frame camera. So how much can the 7D really, what can they really charge for it to get people to choose it? Now, they're not the same thing, and a full-frame camera is not always better. You're right. I did see, however, I was just emailing Juan Pons and I've been listening to his podcast, The Digital Photo Experience, which is an awesome show. Definitely listen to it. And one thing he said that I found really interesting is, I think it was Rick Salmon that did it, actually. Rick Salmon did a test where he had a 5D Mark III shooting on you know, whatever lens it was, 200 millimeters. And he cropped in because, you know, the full frame is wider. And then compared that to, I believe it was a 70D. And he didn't crop in, or maybe it was a 70, and he didn't crop in because it has, you know, the crop factor on the sensor itself. And what he found was he was actually getting better pixels by just shooting it with a full frame camera and cropping in than shooting with a crop sensor camera that has a little bit better reach built in. So I thought that was really interesting.
That's very interesting, and that's the first I've actually heard of that happening. I mean, when I was, the reason that I, beyond talking to you and going with a crop sensor, was I had a gentleman shooting with a 1DX and a 5D Mark III. As you know, those are very expensive cameras, and he was the one who recommended that I go with a crop sensor and say, hey, you know, your 400-millimeter lens would be inadvertently 600 millimeters with a crop factor if you shot that. And now that I've done some more shots, like I did some shots with the Blue Angels when they came through the Omaha area, and I found when I was shooting at 600 millimeters on the 70D and shooting at 400 millimeters on the 6D, when I brought it into Lightroom and cropped, I did like some of the images more that were shot at 400 millimeters and after cropping. I mean, the crop factor, I think that it possibly could kill the image quality a little bit.
Yeah, I would be interested in testing that more. It certainly depends on which crop sensor camera and which full frame body we're shooting with to compare them. But it's interesting that that's an option. I've definitely found that in Nikon world to be true. I'm shooting with the D810, which I love now. And I'm seeing all the time that I can crop in so much with 36 megapixels and the quality is there. I'm often zooming in not to 100%, but sometimes to 50%. and it just looks great. There's no sharpness problem at all. I'm very happy putting that up online, and you know, no problem at all. So if you're on full frame and you have a lot of megapixels, that's a definite possibility to rival a crop sensor. But I really do like crop sensors. I think there are some big advantages to it, not only in this situation sometimes, but like you mentioned, the depth of field. Having better more depth of field for landscape photography is huge. I know portrait photographers are more attracted to the full frame, but as a landscape photographer, there's a real advantage to be able to getting that flower in front of you and the mountains in the distance in tack sharp focus. And you really cannot do that with a full frame camera. If the foreground element is too close to you, it just will not happen. You cannot get enough depth of field and keep a reasonable aperture around f16, maybe up to f22. So there are real advantages to that APS-C size sensor.
Very true. And speaking of your D810, what do you think about the supposedly new Nikon D750 to be unveiled? Are you shooting yourself in the foot for pulling the trigger on the 810 already or not?
No, I could not go to any other camera. In fact, I guess I bought the D4S and the D810 at the same time. So the D4S is whatever, like a $6,500 camera, and the D810 is half the cost. And they're very different cameras. The pricing is different, but they're just marketed to different people. If you shoot sports, you want the D4S. If you shoot landscapes, portraits, other things, I'd give a strong argument for the D810. For the way that I shoot, the D4S went back. I returned it. I can't get over how often I'm able to crop in a huge amount on the photo and get the shot that I want to. I'm changing my composition all the time in Lightroom where I see it and I say, you know what? I was just a little bit too wide. Boop, I can crop in a lot and still have that quality. When I was doing the video of the frog shoot that many of you saw, the macro video where I reviewed a bunch of different macro lenses last week, I shot that with the D4S, and there were several photos that I was shooting with the frog that just... I couldn't quite crop in enough and keep the photo sharp, and it just drove me nuts because I shoot that way so often that, you know, you feel like it's right in camera, of course. Of course, if you felt like it was wrong in camera, you'd change it, but it felt right in camera. But when you get it to the computer, you say, no, I just needed to be tighter. And with the D800, I can always do that. And for me, it's been huge.
Yeah, the megapixels come in handy, and looking at it so far, what they've found about the D750 is it's only supposed to be boasting about 24.3 megapixels, and when I first read that remark, it made me think, is this a Canon?
Yeah, it looks a lot like a Canon. It has lower megapixels, it has higher frame rate, it smells a little bit like a Canon camera, but I think it definitely has utility, because let's say you do shoot sports and you're on the Nikon system and you want something more than the basic, you know, D3200, D5300, something like that. If you want something a little bit more than that, oh boy, you are out of choices right now. The D7100 is a good camera, but it doesn't do as well in low light as I would like it to compared to newer cameras today. And the frame rate isn't stellar. And so that wouldn't be a great choice for sports. The D810 is not such a great option for sports. The D610 is not a great option for sports. It doesn't have that higher frame rate. Basically, your option is spend $7,000 on the D4S. And so I'm really hoping that this camera comes out as it's leaked to be, as we're seeing on Nikon rumors and other websites, because I really feel like Nikon needs something with a higher frame rate at a lower price point.
I agree. And that's one thing that I found also with Canon is on their side of the equation, there are a lot more options for those different types of cameras. Like, for instance, if I wanted to do more portrait work and I didn't have the budget to buy the 5D Mark III, the 6D is definitely doing a sufficient job. And I think the 70D, even though it's a fraction of the price of the 1DX that they have out there, I'm happy with the 70D with its frame rate and using it for that application with sports and fast moving subjects.
Yeah, and for sports, like with the D810, it really is nice to be able to crop in. If I had a little faster frame rate, if I could get to 8-9 frames a second, I could argue that it'd be a great sports camera, because often in sports, you know, it's happening really fast and it's tough to get your composition perfect when it's really fast action. And so being able to crop in would make a lot of sense. But the frame rate at 5 to 6 frames a second for sports, that's just not really going to work so well.
It's not fast enough when you're playing whack-a-mole.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You'd be terrible at whack-a-mole. All right, and there are other things that are rumored to come out at Photokina. I'm sure we're going to see 3 or 4 lenses from Canon and Nikon. It would be awesome if we could see some stuff from Sony too. Again, I love Sony. I'm just waiting to see better autofocus in some of their mirrorless full-frame cameras, and then I'm all about it. But, you know, I'm sure we'll see a good collection of 5 or 6 lenses from each company. One that's been talked about quite a bit is the Canon 100-400, which would be awesome. That one needs updating. It's an older lens. It's a good lens, but an older lens. And there are alternatives that have sprung up that are competing against it. So I think that one could definitely use an update.
Yeah, Canon's definitely due for a refresh on this. When I first bought the 100-400, I have the first version that's available now, and I'm excited about this to hopefully be unveiled, because it does post similar specs. We're looking at a 100-400mm lens that has a variable aperture of 4.5 to 5.6 depending on your zoom, but it's also using the twist ring zoom instead of using the push-pull. And when I bought my lens, and it's such a scary thing to go to a photography shop and pick up a lens and have the guy selling it to you say, okay, this is kind of like a giant bellow. It's sucking a bunch of air in and out as you zoom in and out. And it does have gaskets, but it will fail eventually. And that day that it fails and I have to send it into Canon to get a very, very expensive repair bill, I'm not looking forward to that day. So hopefully this lens comes out before I ever have to run into that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's... Yeah, I think it could be a really neat lens. I hope to see that. The Tamron 150-600 is stealing the show right now. We'll see how it compares to that. The Tamron 150-600, by the way, is a great option for wildlife photography. I was talking to Juan Pons about that this week, and it's a really nice option if you're looking for less expensive lenses and you want something for wildlife.
And one thing to mention with price, too, is they're estimating that this new Canon 100-400 is going to be $2,300. That's almost as much as the coveted 70-200 f2.8 that Canon uses. So that's something to consider, is that hefty price tag. And I actually jumped over to Tamron on my 70-200 because I couldn't justify the extra $1,000, you know, for the Canon name and a tiny bit better, you know, focus and sharpness on it.
Yeah, that's true with a lot of lenses. I've been talking with a lot of people about lenses lately because I'm working on a big project with it. I was talking to or emailing with Lindsay Adler this morning, and I sent her kind of my lens recommendations for a few things to get some input, what she thought. And she said, you're giving short shrift to Sigma. You know, there are some really good Sigma lenses that are better than these Canon and Nikon that are cheaper. And so we talked about some of those, and notably the 85-1.4 from Sigma is awesome. And Tamron is killing it right now. There are, in a lot of cases, not quite to the quality of Canon and Nikon, but so scary close and so much less money that they're really good buys.
Oh, yeah, and if you think about it, it only makes sense they're going to want to put the best product out there, because they're competing with the two largest lens manufacturers out there, and they want it to stand out. I mean, for back to that 70-200 lens, if Tamron's boasting that it's on par with the Nikon and Canon versions of it, that's a big thing to say, and it's really going to have a lot of people look at that lens when they wouldn't have looked at it otherwise.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, we're not just going to see differences in the big boy cameras. We also should be seeing, in a matter of 2 weeks, the iPhone 6 coming out, which is like the worst kept secret on the planet because of so many people are interested in it, that all of the parts of the new phones are getting leaked out, because all they have to do is go to, you know, most of these are being constructed, or parts of it at least are being manufactured in China and other countries. And so all they have to do is go up to some factory worker and say, hey, here's $500, sneak me the back bezel of the phone into your pocket and give me one, you know. And there are thousands of people working on it. It's going to be easy to get those parts. And so these companies can leak all the parts and give us the stats before Tim Cook does. So the iPhone 6 actually has some pretty cool things for photographers. Now, because I know a couple of curmudgeons are going to hear this and snore, I want to say that looking at my Lightroom library, I'm taking a lot of photos with my iPhone. Almost never serious photography, but I'm taking a lot of photos with my iPhone. And why? Because it's in my pocket and the kids are running around and I don't want to run up to my office and grab a DSLR or lug it around the zoo. I want to be able to move around and be a dad, but also take pictures of my kids. And so I'm going to bring the iPhone with me. So I end up taking a ton of photos with my iPhone. In fact, I bet I take a photo with my iPhone 350 out of 365 days a year. I'm constantly taking pictures with it. And so it does make a big difference to me what the camera in the iPhone looks like, because that's a camera that I'm going to be using a lot, even if it's not for any kind of serious work.
Yes, and they're also boasting, as you said previously, in iOS 8, manual controls over the camera, which I think is really amazing. I think cell phone cameras, in essence, and looking at all of them, I think it was a Samsung commercial for all you Android fans out there, we don't want to neglect you, but it has an HDR preview button on there. I think that cell phone technology is really kind of pushing technology up the chain, and I think that if you're going to have a camera in your pocket that's going to be used for the majority of the year, for the majority of your shots when you're on the go, it needs to be a great camera, and I think these phones are doing it. I think they're pushing the point-and-shoot market completely out, and they're having the big boys step up their game.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm anxious to see what happens, and other phone manufacturers have done a lot with cameras as well. But as I look at the stats on improved photography on the website, so all of you guys, whenever you go to the website, it takes stats, all websites do, of what browser you're using, what computer you're using, that kind of stuff. All websites take that kind of stats. And when I look at iPhone compared to Android, even though Androids are far outselling iPhones now, of people that go to improvephotography.com, way more iPhone than it is Android. I mean, way more, even though there are more Android phones in the world. Photographers are using iPhone. Not all of them, and there are great cameras on Android devices, but when it just comes down to the stats, I'm looking at 72-73% iPhone.
And I could probably see why. I looked at some of the stats on my photography site, and I noticed on there that most of my people are either coming in via Google Chrome or they're using Safari, which is on Mac. So if a lot of people are using Macs to edit their photos, and there's nothing wrong with Windows by any means, but if most of them are using that, that's one reason, no matter whether this new iPhone's a flop or whether it's, you know, a winner, I'm going to buy it, because everything else I use for my job is around Apple. So it's just ease of use as well, too.
Yeah, and that I definitely see that as well, that once you're in a system, it kind of makes sense to stick with that system, no matter what system it is.
Exactly. It's even if I wanted to jump over to Nikon right now, it'd be such a huge expense, because I've already married all my lenses. And that's a saying that I always go by. You date your camera body and you marry your lenses. I married my computers and I'm dating my iPhones.
That's right. That's right. Well, in every episode, we want to share a doodad, a device, a resource, a something that we found that week that we want to tell you about. And mine for this week is PicNavi. And thank you to Jeff Briggs, a listener who sent in me a tip on this one. So a long time ago in the podcast, I mentioned, this is back when I was on Android, I had this cool app called Footprints for Android that basically you could just take a picture anywhere and it would just mark your photo location. So you could have like your custom photo locations app, you know, and you know, you could also just look on Lightroom to any of your geotagged photos and see where they were. But this was like to save a specific location and not sort through a bunch of them. So it was just kind of a helpful little app that I used all the time. And so Jeff sent me one for PicNavi. And this one looks really cool for those of you who are on the iPhone. And it's probably one that I'll be using. So thank you to Jeff for sending that in. And I definitely want to give you PicNavi as my doodad of the week. And it, I think it's free. So pretty cool.
Awesome. Awesome. And my doodad of the week has been brought up before, but I can't stress how important it is to look at other people's photography and stay inspired. My doodad of the week is Pixoto. And the reason I'm discussing it again is because if I ever find that I'm unmotivated, if I ever find that I need a new way of shooting something, capturing light, modifying light, anything along those lines, I can always go to Pixoto. And they have challenges on there. I guess I would say the main part is the challenges section of Pixoto. You can win awesome prizes, notoriety, anything on Pixoto by entering their challenges. And they say, okay, take a picture of a cityscape or take a picture of a macro shot of a bug or something, and you can win a prize. I think that that is something that would really help people stay motivated. So definitely take Pixoto and take a look at it.
One thing that I've noticed about Pixoto that I think is cool is, because it's rated by users, by mostly hobbyist photographers, you know, most photographers are not professionals. So because it's mostly hobbyist photographers on Pixoto, I do find that the, what I would consider oversaturated or over HDR'd, overprocessed kind of photos tend to do better on Pixoto than they do on 500px certainly, but other websites. And so one thing to consider when you're using Pixoto is, you know, go for it. Go for a little saturation if you want to get a little bit better of a score. Now, is that better or worse? I don't know. I would say that maybe a less mature kind of photo will succeed on Pixoto that wouldn't succeed with other professional photographers reviewing it would say, this is junk, but tends to do okay on Pixoto because of that. It's just a little bit less mature, but at the same time, it's kind of cool because when you know, your Aunt Stella looks at your photo or Bob down the street, well, they aren't mature photographers either. They aren't, you know, looking at this from an artistic standpoint. They just say, that's cool. And so I think Pixoto is a better representation of the that's cool effect from Aunt Stella, and maybe not as good of a representation or score for your photo as you would get from a professional photographer who's kind of been there and seen it all.
Yeah, and also when you actually click on your photos after you've submitted them, they go through image duels, as you've discussed in previous episodes, but you can actually see why your photo lost to another image by just taking a look at which images your photo won and which one's lost, and then it gives you an idea of why the other photo won. I mean, it could be very subjective as just being framed differently in different area within the category of where your photo submitted, but it gives you a rough idea of how you can improve.
And you can only do that, I think, when you have the pro account, isn't that right?
Yes, I am a pro member on there, so I'm not sure if that's something, if it's disabled for regular users. My apologies on that.
No, that's fine. I'm glad you brought that up. So regular users get to see how many duels you won and how many you lost, but you don't get to see your history of each duel and that you can, you know, do the play-by-play. I lost to this one. Why did I lose to it? And you can, you know, get that for yourself.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, and that's good also for if you want to have that, then sign up for the pro aspect of the count.
Well, very cool. Well, Darren, it's been an awesome episode. 3 products you don't want and a few that you definitely want if they actually come to be. Thanks for joining us on this episode of the podcast, and we will see you next time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.